I think we're being filmed, so maybe you can check that out.
And I want to talk about entanglement between normalization and gauge symmetry. And this is work in collaboration with Luca Tagliacozzo, who has this nice smile. And he's a postdoc at the University of Queensland. We've been working on this for the last year and a half, and only now we decided that it was time to start talking, presenting the results, even though this is work in progress. So some of the results are provisional. What do we want to do? What we're trying to do here is trying to understand how to coordinate a system, a lattice system, which has a local symmetry. So think of your favorite lattice system with a local symmetry. Therefore, you're thinking about the toric code. And suppose that you deform the toric code with a magnetic field. And the question is whether we can exploit the symmetries of the model, the local symmetry of the model, to obtain an efficient or a more efficient description. And also one of the things we'd like to ensure is that we preserve local symmetries exactly. All this discussion is equivalent, and therefore can be used also for lattice game theories on the Hamiltonian formalism. And the example that I'll be working on, all the talk will be with an example, and this will be the toric code, which is equivalent at low energies to the Z2 lattice game theory. And yes, what we get as a result of trying to coordinate a system with a lot of symmetries is a variational lattice, a tensor network variational lattice for the ground state and low energy excited states of the model. Okay, so it was very easy to prepare this talk. It took me a long time because there are many drawings, but the structure is simple. I'll start. This is not a general talk, it's focused. But I will have to start with introducing all the elements that will play a role, and these are, on the one hand, a coordinating transformation, this entanglement and normalization transformation, and on the other hand, I will have to briefly describe a model that hopefully you are all familiar with, which is a toric code, and the relation to C2 lattice gate theory, and then I'll move to describing this coordinating transformation, this coordinating scheme, which will turn out to be made of two parts. One part is an exact transformation. You take your system, you locally modify it with a fixed set of gates, control of gates. This part of the transformation only depends on the local symmetry of the problem, does not depend on any other detail of the Hamiltonian. And then there is a second transformation which has to be done numerically. And this one is the one that depends on the details of the specific system you are analyzing. And just to give you an idea of whether this works, so I'll mention some benchmark remarks, some benchmark results. For instance, we'll be able to deal with systems of up to 500 qubits. And we'll get a reasonable result for quantities such as energy gaps within each topological sector of the theory. We'll talk about non-local order. We'll be able to compute a non-local order parameter. We'll see between different sectors, topological sectors in the theory, we'll see that there is a phase in which indeed you have an exponential suppression of the gap. So the states, the different topological sectors are nearly degenerate. And there is another phase where there is a gap which is linear in the system size. We'll also be able to compute Wilson loops and so on. So we will be able to extract a lot of information from the result of the approach. Basically, we will have a variational wave function for the ground state of the system, and from this wave function, we can extract a number of quantities of interest. All right, so let me start with entanglement and normalization. You've seen this many times today. We have a function spin system. Eventually, we'll be talking about systems in two dimensions, but for simplicity, let me do the talking, most of the talking in 1D. So what we have is, what we would like to do is, we would like to introduce a coordinating transformation. What that is some transformation on the system that produces an effective lattice where the number of spins has been reduced. And in particular, we would like a transformation that preserves locality. And this can be achieved if we break the coordinating transformation, or if we make it as a composition of small pieces. And in that purpose, this will be the type of coordinate transformation I'll consider. And automatically, if you do that, then you can see that the local operator and the operator acting on three spins on the original lattice ends up being an operator acting also on three spins on the Cosgrain lattice. That's good. Local operators are mapped into local operators. You preserve locality. That's an important property. Quickly, for those who like to see how I spent the last night, I'll show you some drawings here. So the idea is we have, this is our operator, three side operator. It's acting on three spins, and now we want to see how the operator transforms when we cosgrain the system. And this is what you have to do, is you have to apply the cosgrain transformation to the operator. You have it here, that would be big W and big W dagger. And we're going to use properties of these tensors. These tensors are not arbitrary, they are constrained to fulfill these conditions, and these are details that I don't want to spend too much time on, but what they imply is that indeed, every time you see U and U dagger, you can simplify it. That cleans a little bit this mess. The point being that at this point, we started with an operator acting on three sides, and we end up with a cosgrain operator that is acting on all the sides of the chain. Now, if you apply this couple of rules, what you can see is that this operator that seems to be acting everywhere is simplified into an operator that is acting as the identity in most of the sides, and only on three sides is you have a non-trivial operator. Okay, so that confirms that we have a cosgrain transformation that preserves locality. So, and then what we can do, and this is, a common strategy, is that we can compose the cosgrain transformation. And in this way, we hope that the Hamiltonian looks simpler every time the effective Hamiltonian becomes simpler, or if we have a finite system, we hope that the system becomes small enough that we can deal with it maybe exactly. We can deal with the effective system exactly. And now if we forget about all the intermediate stages, what we have is a collection of tensors, that we can view as an ansatz for our wave function. So we have a spin system down here, and we have a collection of tensors that we can choose, we can optimize variationally, and we can try to make them as good an approximation to the ground state of the system as possible. Now, this tensor network ansatz has a built-in cosgraining by construction. You've seen that it's related to a cosgraining transformation, and this, in a sense, is an advantage with respect to other proposals, where once you have your variational wave function, you still have to find a way of efficiently extracting information from it. And typically, for instance, if you think about the talks this morning on PEPs, you would it's been mentioned that you have to apply some truncation. You have to start, in order to extract information, you have to start making approximations, which might quite often be in a control. Here you won't have to do that. Another interesting property is that you have tensors at different length scales. So you can encode properties of your system corresponding to different length scales in different tensors. For instance, short range properties, you can encode them in these tensors. Long scale properties, large scale properties, you can encode them in other tensors. And finally, a nice interpretation that is useful and has led to generalizations of this construction is to think of this as a quantum circuit. So you can think of this, you can complement or increase all your tensors. You can think of them as being unitary gates that are acting on initially disentangled spins. You can think of the mirror as you start with a product state, all the spins in state 0, 0, 0. And then you apply a sequence of gates, and you obtain as a result the entangled state, an entangled state that you want to use as an ansatz for your system. All right. So, and in this case, you can think that if your system down here has short-range entanglement and long-range entanglement, then you can think that these gates up here take care of the long-range entanglement, whereas these gates here can only introduce short-range entanglement. So, is that useful? Is it useful to think along these lines? One way of looking at this is we're exploring possible classes of states that can be efficiently contracted. We are trying to identify whether they could correspond in principle to
a parameterization of states that are physically relevant. But in practice, you can also go and test the algorithms. And there have been a couple of tests in two dimensions or two-dimensional lattices that I want to briefly mention. One would be we've been using these techniques to simulate frustrated antiferromagnets, and in particular, Glenn Edenly sitting somewhere there. Was studied the Heisenberg antiferromagnet on the Kagome lattice, and that was a result that seems to be compatible with other techniques, and the results obtained by other techniques, and actually seems to lead to a very low energy, ground state energy. Another type of application have been used in the context of interacting fermions. We can use this fermionic mirror, and that's being worked mostly done by Philip Corbett, to study interacting fermions on a square lattice. And, well, in this reference, you can see explicit examples of ground states, ground state calculation. All right, now, today I want to talk about local symmetries. But the first step would be to briefly tell you what happens if you have a global symmetry. So I want to study how to coordinate a system with a local symmetry, but let's have a look at the case of a global symmetry first. And this is work done in collaboration with Suki Singh and Rob Pfeiffer, who are also, or should be, somewhere here. Where is Suki? Oh, okay. All right. The idea is very simple. Suppose that we have a Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian on our spin lattice is invariant under global symmetry. That means if we apply the same transformation, the same rotation, say, on each of the spins simultaneously, the same, then we let's assume that we have a Hamiltonian that has this symmetry, that it's invariant under the simultaneous rotation of all the spins by the same transformation. Then one thing that you could ask is, can I coordinate my system in such a way that I preserve this symmetry exactly? That's the question that you would like to ask. So in other words, can I, starting from this Hamiltonian here, which has a symmetry, can I choose my tensors in such a way that the final effective Hamiltonian will also have this symmetry? And the answer is quite simple. You can choose, if you choose that your tensors that make this tensor network, this layer, this coordinate transformation, if you choose them to be also symmetric, okay, so in the sense that this tensor here, if you multiply it by this tensor here, you can think of it as a transformation on two spins. If you make this transformation also symmetric, and the same thing for this other tensor, then automatically you could see that the effective Hamiltonian will also be symmetric. That's very easy to see. Yes. These are the details that I don't want to go into. Just wanted to see that you can do global symmetries, and then let's see how you have to change things for a local one.
If you have a symmetry for the tensors, then this is inherited by the Hamiltonian. That's one direction. But would the converse also hold, that if you have a symmetry that it doesn't restrict your ability to pick all tensors to have the same symmetry? You see what I mean?
Yeah, I will take I will just use symmetric tensors, mm-hmm. and I won't try to answer the question of whether it is always the best thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So if you want to see that this final Hamiltonian, effective Hamiltonian, is also symmetric, you just need to ask, okay, so we have that this is the definition of the effective Hamiltonian, it's the original Hamiltonian coordinate, and now we can look at how it transforms under the transformation, and now clearly we have that we can commute these properties down here. So we are using symmetric tensors, the symmetry commutes with the coordinating, and now we have this Hamiltonian. But since it is symmetric, we can observe all these transformations. And remember that this thing here was just the effective Hamiltonian. So we arrive at the fact that we have seen this property. Now this is relatively simple, and the question is, well, first let me discuss why you might be interested in doing this. The first advantage of using symmetric tensors is that you preserve the symmetry exactly. Right, so you start with a system with a certain symmetry, and if you restrict your attention to symmetric tensors, then you have an effective system that has exactly the symmetry is preserved exactly, and that's that's of interest in a context where, remember that we're doing numerical transformations here, and there are, these are approximate transformations. So you want to make sure that, that some properties, some essential properties of the system are not lost within the quaternary. Right? So you on top of that, you will still minimize the energy, but you want to make sure that some elementary properties of your system are exactly preserved. And the other thing is that if you use symmetric tensors, you are able to target specific symmetry sectors of your theory. For instance, in a spinning system, you may want to find the ground state in the singlet sector, but then you may also want to find the first excited state, which is in the triplet sector. You can target, you can limit it. You can limit your assets to go for the triplet sector directly. And finally, if you use this strategy, you can obtain, quite often you can obtain a significant reduction in simulation costs. So it's all good. It's a good idea to use symmetries. So now the natural question would be, what about local symmetries? Can we do something similar for systems of local symmetry? And remember, local symmetry would be a situation where your Hamiltonian is invariant, not under the action of simultaneous action of all the of rotation, the same rotation on all the spins, but actually you can act individually on different spins, and still the Hamiltonian should be the same, should be left invariant. Okay, so let's go a bit more concrete. I'll be discussing things in the context of the toric code. And I'm quite curious, I was preparing this yesterday, I thought, I'll give this talk next week in front of Alex Aikitai. And I was wondering if he would be able to understand the toric code when I explain it. But so this is going to be a quick review. I want to move on to and explain how the quaternary works. I'm assuming that everybody knows a little bit about the toric code, and I'm just trying to introduce the notation. So remember that this is a model, a spin model. We have a lattice, square lattice, I'll consider that we're on a torus. And what we have is spin 1/2 degrees of freedom on the links of the lattice, and there is a Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian, torical Hamiltonian, which is made of two types of terms. These are four spin interactions. There are star operators acting on these four spins for each star, for each site or star. And then you have Laguerre operators, and they are defined here, so star operators as products of sigma x, and Laguerre operators are products of sigma z. And now, the first thing I need to go through is, well, what about ground states of the system? Since all these terms can be shown to commute with each other, you can exactly generalize the system. And the ground state will be, or the ground states will be states that fulfill, that they are, ground states will be any state that fulfills these two types of constraint, namely, for each star operator, when you act on it, the state is left invariant, and the same for each Laguerre. And it turns out that this leads to having four-dimensional vector space, which you can label in terms of the eigenvalues of two operators, x1 and x2. These operators here are defined. These are symmetries of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian commutes with these operators. And x1 is defined as the product of poly of sigma x's along this non-trivial cut here. Remember, this is a torus, and this is a non-trivial cut or root. And then x2 will be defined as the product of sigma x's on this other cut, non-trivial cut. Okay, so for instance, an example. So we have this. We'll choose a basis such that it's an eigenbasis of these two operators, and we'll have four ground states, psi plus plus, minus plus, minus minus, plus minus. And for instance, the plus minus is defined as the one that is an eigenvector of x1 with a plus eigenvector, or plus one eigenvector, and of x2 with a minus one eigenvalue. Alright, so that's known. And I need to introduce a couple of things more, remind you of a couple of things more about the toric code. One is excitations of the model. So in this model we can have, we discussed just the ground states. The ground states fulfill all these constraints, and now suppose that we have a state that violates one of the constraints in a given site. For instance, suppose we have a state that when you apply the operator AS gets back, it's an eigen state of AS with eigenvalue minus one, that will indicate the presence of an electric charge on that side, S. And for instance, you can create charge states from the ground state by applying a sigma z. Right? You start with the ground state, now you apply sigma z on a given link, and that creates a pair of electric charges, and you can actually move them around, and so on. And there is another type of excitations, magnetic vortices, which would correspond to violations of the term. And again, you can create them locally in pairs by applying sigma x on the vacuum on a given link, and that creates a pair of magnetic vortices, and then you can move them. All right, so that was the 5-minute summary of the Tori code. And it was just an excuse to introduce all these colors and drawings. So what I will consider here is a component deformation of the Tori code. Namely, I will consider the case where the original Hamiltonian for the Tori code, to the original Hamiltonian we add a magnetic field on the x direction. And that means these colors here just means that I want you to be able to follow them in the drawings. So we have star, plaquette, and then magnetic field. Magnetic fields act on each side, but independently. They are single side operators syntax. And this is the model we'll be studying. So what do we know about this model? We know ground states. Well, we know this perturbation commutes with the first part of the Hamiltonian, and as a result, you can still, all ground states fulfill that they are eigenstates of, or they fulfill the plaquette, the star constraints. This Hamiltonian still has a symmetry, which is this Hamiltonian still commutes with this non-contractible CAT operators, H1 and H2. And so we still have four topological sectors. Your Hamiltonian breaks into four pieces, which we are still going to, the ground state in each sector will still refer to in the same way as before. And now what I want to focus on is in the property of this Hamiltonian, which is that it has a lot of symmetry. Namely, you take a Hamiltonian, you apply, and you choose a side, an arbitrary side, and you choose an arbitrary side, say this one. You multiply the Hamiltonian by conjugation with the star operator, and you left, you have a Hamiltonian bar. Okay? And this is a property, you can apply this transformation on any side, the Hamiltonian is invariant. So that's a local symmetry, and that's the type. This is an example of the question, the problem I wanted to address before. So, can we incorporate this? The question I want to answer is, can we incorporate this local symmetry into a cosine scheme? How do we incorporate this local symmetry? That's much more powerful in principle than global symmetry. What can we do? In such a way that we preserve the symmetry exactly, that we, if we start with a model with a local symmetry, we would like to obtain an effective model which still has a local symmetry, and then also can we get a significant reduction in simulation cost? So that's what I want to do. And just one last comment is that in some limit, so namely if I take this coupling large enough, then what we have is that the spectrum of the theory will have ground states or nearly the generic ground states down here. And then we'll have a gap to magnetic vortex excitations, and then we'll have a much larger gap to electric charge excitations containing electric charges. And therefore, if we look at this system at low energies, we will end up working with subspace, which only contains magnetic vortices. Okay? And this is, if we do that, then we are back to what we recover, Z2 lattice gauge theory. Okay? So that's what I want to do, actually. I want to look at a system where I want to contain a system such that at low energies, all the states fulfill this constraint, star constraint. And this is the same as working with Z2 lattice gauge theory. If we do that, then we have to project the original system, the original Hamiltonian, on the subspace of states that fulfill these local constraints, and we obtain the Hamiltonian of Z2 lattice gauge theory.
And so just a remark before we start with the cosheraining, specific cosheraining transformation. The remark is that, well, what happens with the symmetries of the problem? This Hamiltonian here still has this non-trivial operator. It still commutes with x1 and x2, the non-trivial, non-contractible cuts. But as far as local symmetry, this local symmetry is gone, right? Because that this constraint, we are working with a sat space that is characterized by states that fulfill this condition. And saying now that in this sat space you have star operators, well, generate a symmetry. It's a trivial statement, right? This operator on that sat space acts as the identity, and so there is no local symmetry in this model. But anyway, the idea here is I'll be talking about local symmetries, and I'll be talking about corresponding lattice gauge theories, and the approach that I'll describe next works for both cases. So how do we do this? Or this is a specific proposal. There might be better ways of doing that. Suppose we don't have a symmetry, or suppose we don't have a local symmetry, or suppose we don't exploit it. Then we would go back to what I described before. You have your lattice here. Each line here represents a spin. We would take some cosheraining transformation, which may break into tensors, and then we would obtain an effective description in terms of a reduced number of spins. Now we're going to do something fancier. And this is what we're going to do. So what we'll do is we'll take our system and we'll apply first an exact transformation. Okay, this will be a sequence of control nodes, actually. And this will generate a new system. And after that, our system will be converted, or the Hamiltonian will be transforming into a new one such that we'll have three types of spins.
We're transforming the system, right? So we have a mapping on the Hilbert space, and you can apply it to states, or you can apply it to the Hamiltonian. So there is a transformation, which will be isometric, actually, such that after applying it, you obtain, if you were to apply it to the Hamiltonian, you would see that the Hamiltonian reorganizes itself, and you can define three types of spins. Right? We started with all spins were equivalent. Now, after that, we'll have three types of spins. One type will be in a state which is completely determined by the local symmetry. Actually, they will be in state plus, and they will, you can project them out from the picture without introducing any approximation. And there will be two other types of spins. Another type of spin will still be constrained by the symmetry, and it is denoted by these lines coming up, these thick lines coming up. And then there will be a third type of spin, which is no longer constrained by the symmetry. Okay, there will be spins on which the star operators are no longer active. Okay, and so once we've done that, we'll take the free spins, the spins on which the symmetry is no longer acting, and we'll apply some numerical cosheraining transformation to them.
Okay, and then how would we proceed if we were not exploiting any symmetries? Well, we would reiterate the transformation.
But at any stage,
I can restrict my attention to the lattice gauge theory.
So I'm just wondering if this class and those correspond to the A.
These are guys who would not be in the gauge theory anyway, in the lattice gauge theory.
These
are just constraints. It's an expression of a local constraint. Yes. So we will reiterate the same procedure. We'll have always, in this case, we'll start with constrained spins and free spins. And then we'll take care of constrained spins with an exact transformation, which will free some of the spins. And some of other spins will be completely determined by the symmetry, and then some other spins will need to be left for the next level. And what we have is that the new free spins, together with some free spins from previous level of course running, can be further constrained numerically, and so on. And then this weird-looking thing is going to be our variational ansatz for the theory. Okay?
The only happens on the right hand side, right? And that's because the exact
It is exact, but it's Coserenning as well. It's just that it only depends on the properties of the local symmetry. Yes. So let's have a look at this exact transformation. As I said, it takes original spins. It divides them into three types, the ones that are constrained, completely determined, specified by the local symmetry, and two more types. So we can get rid of the ones that are completely specified by the symmetry because they are in a product state. They are not entangled with the rest of the system. And then we're left with these two types. And we will keep dealing with this part as with the original ones. So these are this part here, these spins still have star constraints on them. These ones no longer have star constraints.
Just to clarify, if you would also go to the electric charges, you have minus four.
You could do that, but you would only be allowed to decide a priori whether some links, some star operators are violated or not. You cannot have linear combinations. Yes, so you could have electric charges there, static electric charges, and you could put them there, yes. Okay, so I think that what I want to do is to quickly tell you how this works. And I will use a number of results, as particular results by Daniel Gottesman, his thesis, and also later results by Dennis et al. Well, the idea is that we can take the toric code. The toric code, first of all, can be defined on an irregular lattice where star operators will now involve more or less than four spins, and the plaquette operators may also involve three spins or four, any number of spins. And the idea is that we can modify this irregular lattice by means of control knots. So suppose that this is part of my lattice, and I have the toric code Hamiltonian defined on this lattice. If I apply a control knot between these two spins, then the lattice will be transformed in a very regular or in a simple way into a new lattice with still a toric code Hamiltonian there. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take, this is the toric code on the original lattice, I'm going to apply a sequence of C-knots to this lattice to obtain a new lattice that will look like this. So the specific sequence is not too important. The idea is that you can do this for any value, for instance, of the magnetic field. So that part is fixed. And the net result is that starting from this region of the lattice where all the spins are equivalent, I just have bigger spins here. Just it's a guide to the eye. Doesn't mean anything at this level, but these are the guys which will remain constrained later on. So we start with a lattice where all the spins are equivalent, and after this transformation we have that four of the spins are still organized as if they were in a regular lattice, a square lattice, and the rest of the spins are in a weird situation, specifically the ones that this three here happen. You can argue, or it can be argued, that they are in a product state that follows directly from the rules from the stabilizer formalism. And therefore, I can remove them. So they don't appear here anymore. And then the rest, these qubits, or these spins are the ones that I've been calling free spins. And let me argue in which sense they are free. So summarizing, there is a sequence of C-naught gates. And it maps, this sequence will map this toric code Hamiltonian into this toric code Hamiltonian. And if you look at star operators on this new toric code Hamiltonian, they are only acting on the big circles, not on the small ones. That means that that we have these two types of spins after the Coserenning, some spins on which there is a star operator acting, and some other spins on which there is no star operator acting. Now, what happens to plaquette operators under this exact transformation? Turns out that original plaquette operators are transformed into two types of operators. Some plaquette operators become magnetic fields, acting only on one of these spins, and some other plaquette operators become delocalized within a plaquette, within a new plaquette. But the important point here is that all these terms are local. They are localized within a small region of the system. And what happens to the magnetic field, what happens to the original magnetic field that we applied, the perturbation, the deformation of the toroidal? Well, it turns out that it becomes a coupling, an Ising coupling between nearest neighbors on the free spins. And there is another term. So every time, so the coupling is within each plaquette. But if you have a coupling between spins that are free spins that are in different plaquettes, the coupling is mediated by one of these bigger spins, the ones that are still constrained. And this is very suggestive of gauge matter coupling, though we have not been able to show. Well, the idea here would be that maybe this is indicating that the emergence of some matter that is coupled. We started with only gauge fields, and now we obtain a coupling that reminds us of as if the free spins would behave as matter. But in any case, again, all these terms are local. And so now we can compose this with a numerical transformation. And in this particular work, we've chosen a simplified, what we choose is we take every three spins, which are in a plaquette, and we put them together as an effective site. And that's the variational answer. So if, I guess I'm running out of time. Okay. So now we have these answers, and the question is, well, is it useful? And let me discuss, let me tell you a property of these answers that is already a good sign, which is the following. Suppose, so let's take then the toroidal. What we have here is, let's consider this coupling is very large, so it's out. We don't consider this one. And now let's look at what happens as a function of the perturbation, magnetic field. We could consider a small magnetic field. Then we would be back to the toroidal. And this is a highly entangled state, the toroidal. But it turns out that when you do this transformation, the free spins appear in a product state. Okay, so you have a highly entangled state that after this Coriolanian this exact transformation becomes a product state. So that is really good news. It means that these answers, or with this method, you can very efficiently simulate the topological phase of the toroidal. And in particular, for zero magnetic field, we recover some construction of a couple of years ago with Miguel Aguado and myself. And in the other limit, you have a spin polarized phase. And again, you can see that this answer leads to a product state. So again, it's very cheap to simulate. And the question is, what happens in between? What happens between the topological, so between the toroidal or zero magnetic field and very large magnetic field? And in that case, these free spins are entangled. But you can see that they are less entangled than they would have been without this exact transformation. So I think that I don't have time to explain the numerical results. I'll be around for a week if anybody's interested.
Is that you recover the toroidal? You mean if you run this simulation that in the specific case of no perturbation, you would just exactly recover the exact tensor network?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and it's a product state in this new variable.
Okay.
Yes. So yeah, you can do a number of things, compute energies. You can localize the critical point with relatively with some precision. But these results are provisional anyway. We are still trying to figure out how large we want to make the system. You can check. For instance, you can see that there are two phases depending on the value of the magnetic field. For zero, for small magnetic field, you have that the degeneracy ground state, you have different grounds, you have different topological sectors, and you can check that the energy difference between ground states on different topological sectors decays exponentially in the system size, so that would be the system size, and you can see that this gap between sectors decreases exponentially in the system size, whereas if you are on the other phase, on the spin polarized phase, then the energy between topological sectors actually grows linearly in the system size. And similarly, you can compute Wilson loops and see that. Yes, this is the gap between topological sectors. No, so within a topological sector, you would have a. Yes, yes. So, right. you have, globally, you only have one ground state. But if you restrict your attention to a given topological sector, you could ask what's the lowest energy state there. And I'm saying that this lowest energy state has an energy which is L times larger than the real ground state, or the gap grows linearly in the system size. But these are all well-known results. We were just trying to see whether the method would reproduce them. Okay, it's just a consistency check. This system has been studied by many people, and we were just trying to see whether we could get, with just one single method, all the results that were known. And I think that I'll stop here. Well, yeah, Wilson loops for those who are interested. And then the summary is that this is work in progress. And in particular, that we have not even tried to add these numerical disentanglers. So we still have the many more degrees of freedom we can play with. And the idea would be to add disentanglers so that we can go to infinite systems and also to recover fixed points of the RG flow. And also, we've been playing around with adding an arbitrary perturbation to the model, in which case we lose the local symmetry, but the idea is that you can recover it in an emerging way. And finally, extensions of this. So the idea of studying the Z2 or the toric code, this is not very exciting, actually. All the results are known. But what we were trying to do is we're trying to devise a strategy that will allow us to attack more interesting problems. And in particular, we already know how to change the Z2 by any non-abelian group, discrete group. And we have some ideas of how to switch to continuous group. For any discrete group, we actually the exact transformation was something that was discussed by Miguel Aguado and myself some time ago. And then also we have analogous constructions for string net models, learning to learn string net models, where we also discussed the exact transformation a year ago. So the idea is that this approach can be generalized to much more interesting structures, and hopefully it will turn into an efficient way of simulating otherwise quite entangled systems. Thanks.
Yes, one of my big problems over the weekend was that we thought we could, and then we thought we couldn't. So I wasn't sure whether. Yeah, I think that we have not been able to do it yet, but we have a number of quantities which behave in a very similar way, so it's work in progress. Yes. You mean entanglement, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, one big motivation to use counterproductive states is that it can characterize this topological algorithm. Yes. And so I just want to say, using this method and just a straightforward this variational approach using counterproductive states, do you see any what advantage or disadvantage? You know, what's the motivation there?
The motivation? Well, all the calculations we made were for traditional order parameters in this model, but you can see that you can look at the gaps. For instance, one of the things we can do easily is not just get the ground state, but actually a pile of states on top of the ground state.
To get the excited state, you have a trial wave function different sector, or you have a Hamiltonian to diagonalize to get excited.
Well, you can take your Hamiltonian lifted through the coordinating, and then they analyze it on top.
So here, the advantage here, you have effective Hamiltonian, not just a one-trial.
You have, you have the wave function if you want, but you can also have a wave function for a whole set space. Yes.
So the space transition you talked about, right here, that's presumably icing.
Yes,
the usual z equals.
Yes.
So. There's a fine-tuned Hamiltonian you can write down some of it. It's not an icing transition to the ordered phase. So is there any reason why that?
Wait, sorry. You
can fine-tune a Hamiltonian, make it frustration-free to use. Heard this morning. So that the ground state changes in a way that you know something. So basically, you force it to be a 2D classical icing phase transition. And so the 2D quantum thing is now some other weird.
That this
modification of the Hamiltonian respect the local symmetry?
Yeah. That's the one we did with Cloud.
Yeah. Well, right. Yeah, it's in the stuff we did with.
But does it respect the local symmetry?
The local symmetry.
Yes.
I mean, the gauge geometry always depends on how you write it. So, it's redundancy. So.
That would be something that we
because then you'll get some funny, you'll get very different exponents than you get.
Okay.
So what's the difficulty if you have the sigma y? Because I think if you have a sigma x and sigma y philosophy of that, then this is completely unknown what happens with the phase diagram. Is there any difficulty?
I don't think it's completely unknown. There are some papers. So sigma x plus sigma y.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, no, I don't know.
You don't have local symmetry.
No. Okay, so this simulation here where preserving a local symmetry, we also run simulations where you don't preserve any symmetry. And then the complexity is...
But do you get the same result?
Same result? Which result?
If you don't impose a symmetry and you run your mirror, you get the same results, or somehow the small kind of imperfections will grow and build up such
that... For small system sizes, actually we could not run a mirror in this system. Glenn, you tried for a while, right? Run a mirror on the body code. There was some...
I just even the ground state of the exact amplitude of torque code is probably too computationally difficult with the mirror.
You could encode it, so we have an exact expression in terms of a mirror, but if you try to find it variationally from scratch...
And if you oppose this symmetry, then you find it?
Yes. And it's a product, it looks like a product state, actually, on this...
But it's because you fixed these, you know?
No, the CNOT gates, they're not the...
Oh, these are fixed?
These are fixed.
Okay.
And are valid for any perturbation of a component that respects the local symmetry.
But you don't put in the product state, it just comes out.
It comes out.
One more urgent question before the coffee break. So let's thank you for the We'll be back by 4 minutes.
A little higher dimension.